Hi everyone, Christian Brady here. This is an extra special podcast created with a group of classicists, economists, and philosophers who've been working together all summer on a project called In the Agora. It's a site that looks at the crossroads between ancient Greek and Roman philosophy and its reception in pop culture. There are some great articles up. Some of my favorites include The Climb and the Republic, talking about HBO's Game of Thrones and the Platonic Dialogue. There's another article called Are Babies Evil? That is thoroughly frightening, and there are many, many more articles. You can find the site at socrates.arts.ubc.ca/agora. Today on the show, we're featuring a sort of roundtable debate and discussion among two major Hellenistic schools of philosophy, which inherited different aspects of Socrates' philosophical teachings in the 4th century BCE. Also, we thought we'd take a look at an alternative to ancient philosophy, ancient religion, in the form of the Orphic mystery cult, which predates the Hellenistic schools by at least a couple centuries, and persists through the Hellenistic period and beyond. Plato even gives them a special shout-out in one of his dialogues. At issue is which of the philosophies, or belief systems, would be best suited to people living today. The show comes in two acts. First act is a little introduction by each of the belief systems and a larger discussion of Greek religion in general, which looks at the ways in which all of these philosophies were united by certain similarities. In the second act, we leave time for rebuttals and some good old Athenian knockdown, drag-out intellectual brawling. Let's get started.
If you were living in ancient Greece, you could have gone down to the Agora and see representatives from some of the best schools presenting their best arguments against each other. In particular, you'd have the Stoics versus the Skeptics, and perhaps on one day a Skeptic would do worse, but you know they'd come back and give an even better argument. What we want to do today is give you a bit of a flavor of those kinds of arguments, as several different schools, the Stoics, the Epicureans, and the religious group, the Orphics, each try to convince you about why their way is the best way to live your life.
Hi everyone, my name is Grace Kang. I'm a fifth year student at UDC studying a double major in poli-sci philosophy. I'm here today to participate in this philosophy debate on how best to live our life.
Hello, my name is Andre Michaluk. I'm a second year MA student in classical archaeology, but I did my undergrad in classics, so I'm pretty versed in ancient philosophy and especially Aristotelian philosophy. And I'm going to be acting as a kind of fact checker and sort of a third-party mediator in this little discussion.
My name is Norman Chalk. I'm currently pursuing a Bachelor of Arts in Economics at UBC, and I'll be representing the Epicurean philosophy.
My name is Lisa Tweeton. I'm a second-year MA student in the ACRE program at UBC. I'm going to be representing the Orphic religion rather than a philosophy, because if we're talking about how to live your life is a brief spark in the void of eternity, and how do you want to spend the rest of that eternity?
It's very dramatic.
Front-loading the argument.
My name is Christian Brady. I'm in the Classics Department MA program at UBC. I'm studying Senecan drama right now, and so I will be making some kind of argument for the Stoic way of life.
So Christian, we're going to start with Christian, and he's going to talk about his position on Stoicism. And so, Christian, would you like to start on that?
Yeah, sure. I don't think that this debate is really... I think there were a lot of points in which the Stoic way of life has really translated well into the modern world. I think that a lot of the values that we have as Americans and as just people of Western culture, Canadians, I guess, too, but I'm from America, so a lot of our values are Stoic values. I think the number one here, between the Orphics and the Epicureans and the Stoics, is that we don't value happiness above virtue. We would rather do the right thing than be happy doing the wrong thing. The Stoics also believe in some like ancient proto form of intelligent design. They think that God is the architect and watchmaker for all things, and that all things are beautiful and complex, and that this is somehow an indication that he's, you know, around and guiding things toward the future. So this leads to some form of fate and destiny, which is a Stoic idea. And also the Stoics were really into hashing out their opinions and their arguments through what we're doing right now, dialectic, because they felt like dialectic argument was a great way of arriving at the truth. So I want to just build on how the American and Canadian cultures are an offshoot of Stoic thought.
Okay, so Pythagoreanism is going to come up a little bit at the beginning of the discussion. I'm just going to give you a brief background, the very little bit that I know. So Pythagoras, you probably know him as the triangle guy, a squared plus b squared equals c squared. If you're not sure what that is, go check out our blog, because Norman posted a fantastic video.
By heart's video.
But he also had a couple of theories about the soul. So Pythagoreanism is kind of an ethical, religious set of beliefs about how to live your life. It's kind of a philosophy, but he talks a lot about the soul. He believes the soul is immortal, tied to a mortal body, and that when you die, your immortal soul will be reincarnated as an animal or a human. He had also a very strong bias that philosophers and mathematicians live the best lives because a life of pure contemplation is the highest order. And he compares it to people attending the Olympic Games. So the lowest of the low are the people who show up to the Olympic Games to sell you stuff. The middle of the road, the not so bad but not so great people, are the people who participate in the Olympics. And the greatest of all people are the ones who stand around and watch. So the philosophers and mathematicians who couldn't hold a candle to anyone in the javelin throw are actually the best people. So there you go.
Nice.
Not biased at all by his.
That was his argument.
Sounds like a good one.
Okay, Lisa, if you'd like to tell us a little bit of intro of Orphicism.
Sure. So the Orphic religion, I guess, is really based around, as far as I can tell, a specific myth of Orpheus, who was a semi-divine creature in Greek mythology. His mother was one of the muses. So he had this ability to play music really well. He charmed the savage beast. Anyway, his wife, Eurydice, dies, and Orpheus is distraught. So he decides to go to the underworld and get her back. He travels through the underworld, navigating the various dangers, and he finds himself in front of Persephone and Hades. He plays his lyre for them and potentially sings a really beautiful love song about how his love is gone and he can't survive without her, and he charms Persephone to the point where she agrees to let Eurydice go back to the upper world with him. And so they just walk out, everything's fine, happy, great, he got his wife back. There's another version of the story that comes out in the early Roman Empire where he fails. He looks back when he's not supposed to and he loses. But that's a Roman thing. That's not actually part of the Greek early history of Orpheus. So a bit of a religious following springs up because there's this semi-divine, half-mortal figure living in Thrace who's been to the underworld and successfully retrieved somebody back. So basically there's a bunch of texts that are found in burial contexts that describe a path you take through the underworld if you don't want to be just a shade, the way most souls are. You live in the underworld, you can't eat or drink, you're constantly kind of miserable, you can't speak unless somebody above you pours blood and wine on the ground and calls you forth and they can talk to your shade for a brief moment. Your ancestors have to consistently pour libations on your grave for you to even survive in this miserable existence. So if you follow the path of Orphism, what you get is instructions on how to get to the Elysian Fields, or like a heavenly kind of place. And I'm just going to read really briefly one text that was found in a grave. in southern Italy. So it goes, "You will find in the halls of Hades a spring on the left, and standing by it a glowing white cypress tree. Do not approach this spring at all. You will find the other from the Lake of Memory, refreshing water flowing forth. But guardians are nearby. Say, I am the child of earth and starry heaven, but my race is heavenly, and this you know yourselves. But I am parched with thirst, and I thirst and I perish, but give me quickly refreshing water flowing forth from the Lake of Memory. And then they will give you to drink from the divine spring, and then you will celebrate the rites with the heroes." So basically there's two types of water in the underworld. There's the water of forgetfulness and the water of memory. And you have to be very, very careful not to drink the water of forgetfulness. Do drink the water of memory. And the other thing that they would do is they would place gold plaques on people's mouths in the grave that just basically say, "To Persephone, I am an initiate." Because when you first enter the underworld, apparently you're not allowed to speak unless you're recognized as an initiate. So you can't even plead your case to go to this heavenly place.
Okay. So, lastly, Norman, would you also like to talk about Epicureanism?
Yes. So, Epicurus will advocate a type of life which is in a closed community with friends. And there's going to be a number of people who will try to make quite a few clever arguments, and they'll try to persuade you about particular things. But in the end, we know that the one target that everybody's going for is pleasure. You're looking for the best kind of life for yourself. You want to be happy. And while Epicurus has a physical system, and he does have a system for how you can know things, what he's very concerned about is how you live. And while there are a number of doctrines that he will leave to you, there's really only four that you need to achieve that tranquil and happy life. Those are the realization, one, that God is blessed and imperishable, and he neither suffers nor inflicts trouble. So we don't have to worry about the gods monitoring us, or we don't need to worry about the gods coming in and doing things that we don't like. They're perfectly happy, and they could really care less about what's going on in the world. They're living a tranquil life just like we should aspire to. The second source of trouble for our lives is the fear of death. And Epicurus very wisely told us that death is nothing to us because we have a life of sensation. And once you die, you have no sensation. And things without sensation mean nothing to us. So why should I fear death? I'm not going to be around for it. Now, in terms of the type of life that you'll live in, quote-unquote, the real world, which, as far as we're concerned, is the only one to talk about, the removal of all pain is the limit of the magnitude of pleasures. You can't have pleasure while there is pain. It's the same reason why, when you're really, really thirsty, that's kind of the only thing that you can focus on. And it feels great to drink water because you've now removed that pain from your life. And the final realization is that pain does not last continually in the flesh. This might sound a little bit obscure, but the best that I can say for right now is the idea that there are two kinds of pain that everybody kind of knows about, which is, number one, you have that very sharp, acute pain, but you only really feel that for a short period of time. And anybody can really say this. If I burn my hand on the stove, that doesn't last forever. Whatever comes after it kind of lasts for a while. But even in long-term pain, such as those of sickness or those other ones, I do have these mental faculties, and not only can I anticipate getting better or, you know, kind of being able to anticipate some good things that will happen to me, which is why, you know, I can hold off maybe not eating a snack before dinner so I can really enjoy that dinner that I'm preparing for myself. But it also allows us to recall the good times that happened before. And so this is the kind of life that really gets back to the basics. It says that, do you want to live the happiest life? Well, focus on doing things that make you happy. And don't overindulge in them, because there's nothing saying that tomorrow there won't be anything that takes them away. So you want a life of self-sufficiency, you want a life lived with your friends, and you want one where you're free from these troubles that life may or may not bring to you in the future.
well, why don't we start with, if you have any questions about historical context or anything like that. I mean, and Andre, you've been listening too, so if you have anything that you want sort of like parsed out further, like maybe we can answer those questions before we go forward with the more formal argument.
Right. I was a little bit confused with Lisa's introduction. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to, like, are you able to give me like a pinpoint on like
on actual dates for things?
Not actual dates, but like how you are going to argue for, because I've been given a lot of background information, but I wasn't sure like where you're going.
I mean, I'm going to have a hard time arguing for it because I don't believe it.
Okay.
I'm an atheist.
I'm not an Epicurean.
No, but it's much
oh,
easier
that,
to argue
we didn't
for
come in. Oh, okay. All right.
I'm an Epicurean. I can argue for Epicureans.
But I can at least argue that given the culture that those people lived in, it was a valid belief system that relieved some anxieties they had about life, maybe.
Okay.
I think what she's looking for is why should somebody become an orphan?
Right? Yeah, more along those lines.
Okay, I mean, I guess if you think about philosophy and religion, philosophy is more concerned with how do I live, right? Religion is kind of concerned with how do I live and also what happens when I die. So if you want the good afterlife, orphan religion would say there are a couple of specific things that you have to do in life. There's some purification rituals, which we don't particularly know about, but all Greek religion had purification rituals. You wash your hands before you enter the sacred temple area. You could sacrifice to relieve a stain of some sort. And the very, very specific details of how they live their lives are pretty much non-existent because it's a mystery religion, right? You don't talk about Fight Club kind of thing.
but how is this? Because there's a fundamental assumption that there is afterlife. So
yes.
How are you going to persuade those who don't believe in at all? That we should sacrifice certain things, that we should do certain things, and while they're still living, such that they can get their rewards in the end. But
right.
Then, if they don't believe in that, then you know how can you tell someone not to do something in life, you know, to sacrifice what they want to do?
Right. I mean, I would say that what the Orphics are asking you to sacrifice is pretty minor. They're not saying you can't sleep around. You can covet your name. Neighbor's wife, you can go to war, you can do all of those good Greek things. One thing that they potentially did ask you to do, which was kind of subversive in their society, was don't eat meat. And not
no way, really?
Early vegetarians, so I've got the vegans and the PETA team on my side.
Way.
Yeah, potentially. Because a lot of the texts that we do have from funeral contexts, they talk about purity and abstaining from a sin that is never specifically mentioned. But all of their libations that they talk about are milk rather than blood or wine.
So the vegans aren't on your side.
No, not the vegans. I do have the vegetarians, but the vegans are messed up anyway. Sorry.
It sounds Pythagorean.
Yes.
Like the Pythagoreans were also people who believed, didn't they believe in some kind of like souls for, like even beings had souls, first of
yes.
all?
Yes. Yeah, you're, okay, so the Pythagorean theory is the transmigration of the soul. You are reincarnated potentially as a plant or an animal or a human being. And that explains suffering, because even if you're not punished for your sins in your current lifetime, you can be reincarnated, and if you're a dog, then whoever owns you as a dog is going to beat the living crap out of you. If you're a tree, you're going to be chopped down. If you're a human, you will suffer. You will be homeless. You will be exiled from your community or some sort of way to explain why it appears that people who commit crimes are not always punished and people who appear innocent are sometimes punished. Well, that's just delayed retribution.
Is that related to the Orphic religion or not?
Yeah, there's a lot of ties between the two. I mean, there's some debate because we don't have like an Orphic Bible. We have these very brief texts from burials, but there's no like treaty or dialogue or anything that really deals with their specific practices.
How would you bind people into following those principles? Would it just all come down to faith that they just kind of believe in it, and so they would just, in the same way that some people, they believe in religion.
Well, okay, so ancient religions in general, Greek ones specifically, are rather than orthodoxic, having and insisting on everyone believing in the same faith. These are orthopractic religions. So they're people who believe that you can believe basically what you want, which is why the Epicureans don't get run out of town for being such godless, you know, like baby eaters.
We
just
had our own garden. Stay out.
Right, so like they could believe what they wanted about the gods, basically, within reason. I mean, Socrates was murdered for being basically an atheist. The Greek religions were orthopractic, so they insisted that you do all the things that Greek religion asked you to do, the cleansing and the sacrifice, but that you could believe what you wanted. And this is one of the reasons why Christian religion didn't do so well early on, because they believed in one God, but they wouldn't participate in sacrifice, because they thought that that was wrong.
Right.
So they were weird. They were on the outside because they were orthodoxic rather than orthopractic.
Okay.
So orthopractic religion would have followed basically a lot of the
same. I mean, it wasn't exclusive. It wasn't you can only be orphic. You could have been an Epicurean orphic who also enjoyed the Eleusinian mysteries or, you know, sacrificed something. Potentially not an animal, or maybe there's no real punishment for breaking the taboo about eating an animal, as long as you're purified at that moment when you go into the ground, right? Like, you could be a complete degenerate and still have somebody, like, douse you with milk, wrap you in white wool, put a gold plate on your mouth, send you down to the underworld as an initiate because you are aware of the mysteries. Potentially, you didn't have to live up to them in every moment of your life, much like any religion now, because we all fail.
Sorry. So I'll just call something out here. I don't believe it's possible to be an Epicurean orphic because we very clearly do not believe that the soul lasts beyond death, that the soul is inside of us, or the psyche, which is the animating principle. So it's not necessarily something that grows wings when you come out. As far as we're concerned, that's done when you die.
Right.
And the problem that we have with orphism is that it's focusing on this worry about what's going to happen to you when you die, and that suddenly brings quite a bit of disturbance into your life. You're not going to be enjoying life if you're really worried about what's going to happen to you after.
This is one of the... Go ahead.
Sorry. One thing in the myth of Orpheus going to get Eurydice that I genuinely don't understand how they reconciled this themselves, you bury the body or you burn the body of your wife, but then you go to the underworld and she's somehow corporeal enough that you can take her back and continue to have a life and make children with her. So I'm not sure that they would necessarily disagree with the Epicureans that the soul is separate from the body. Potentially, the fire was just a transformative thing that put all of you into the underworld because he brought something back that he could love and hold. I don't know. I mean, I prefer the Epicurean view that the psyche is what animates you, and when you're dead, you're dead. You don't have to sit around for an eternity just hoping that things worked out for you, because eternity is a very long time. Nobody wants that with their relatives, do you really? Anyway.
Okay.
Any other questions?
So, I mean, one of the other things I would say is that I study classics because of the literature side of it. And the only reason that I know about the Pythagoreans is because it's popularized in, like, book 6 of the Aeneid, where Virgil talks about the transmigration of souls. And so, I mean, there's an extent to which Romans, at least, didn't subscribe to a single philosophy. I mean, I studied Seneca, and Seneca's, like, one of those rah-rah Stoics. But, like, for even Seneca had views that weren't necessarily Stoic. I mean, when he writes his tragedies, those aren't just Stoic treatises. They build on other traditions. So, like, there were people who believed in seemingly contradictory things and were still able to, like, walk around without having their heads explode, that sort of thing.
I mean, I'm not sure if Virgil was a Pythagorean and an Epicurean and a Stoic at the same time, but he definitely wrote about them all in the same book, which was kind of cool.
I'll maybe ask a question of my own to try and flesh out one of your other ones. Let's say that I am religiously inclined, and we did talk about maybe being able to adopt several religions, but that's still kind of pushing the question one step back, which is that I can either be an Orphic or I cannot be an Orphic, whether or not I have all of these other ones. So what is a unique trait of Orphism that would make this a religion that I would want to adopt as opposed to something that I would reject?
Just to build on top of Norman, by the way of how Lisa described it, it sounded like there isn't like a very strict principle with Orphicism. Like it sounded more like it gives you a great leeway of how you can act and behave. Well, if that's the case, then what's the point of adopting Orphicism?
Well, the point of adopting Orphicism, I guess like any religion, is to guarantee that you get the good option when you die, right? You're just checking the box, yeah, I'm open for your email subscription list, you can send me notices about this, and I'll play along on the off chance that there's two rogues in hell, and one goes to the bad place and one goes to the happy little everlasting party. I'm being a little bit glib here, but the Greek concept of God and religion is quite different from the Judeo-Christian, where God cares about you. Greek gods did not care about you. You were minor annoyances, and occasionally they would rape you for fun. So displeasing them was a big, big thing that you worried about, but pleasing them was arbitrary. And so you would sacrifice, and you would go to the festivals because it's a barbecue, and your family and friends are there, and it's fun. But also you don't want to piss off Zeus or anybody else, really. So Orphism really offers one of the first concepts that when you die, instead of just being kind of shoved in the ground and forgotten and miserable, things don't have to be miserable. That there's a place where heroes go, that they've earned through their lifetime, but that you can also earn the right to go there by obtaining knowledge. And part of the tie with Pythagoreanism is that the transmigration of the soul, yes, but you could also like break free from that cycle of reincarnation and just stay in heaven. And it's part of it is a quest for knowledge. Because it's a mystery religion, we have no idea what they told their followers really beyond this like path in the underworld. But the other part of it is just hope that there is potentially not just misery awaiting you. And if you read Hesiod, ancient Greek life was miserable. Your best bet was to get an ox and a wife that you didn't hate and hope that your children didn't kill you to get the farm. So going somewhere where you can have some wine and smell some flowers sounds like pretty good if all you have to do is be like, yeah, okay, I'll subscribe to that for a bit.
See, the problem with the subscription to the God services was I got these emails, all nude muses, for like a month after subscribing. It sucked.
It sucked for you, maybe, but I think a lot of the ancient Greeks would be into that.
Okay. On the point of not displeasing, you don't have to please God, but you don't want to displease them. Well, can you build a elaboration on that? Because what I'm getting at, it sounds like people are just doing the decent minimum. They don't have to go beyond.
No. You bend over backwards. You always, if you're a sailor, every day you say, thank you, Poseidon, for not killing me. I love you, Poseidon. Here's a chicken. Enjoy.
Because you don't want to piss them off.
You don't want to piss them off, but you have no idea what might piss them off. You give them a chicken with a black feather, maybe that pisses them off. You give him a chicken at 10:02 instead of 10:05, maybe that pisses him off. You have no idea. The gods are very capricious, so you're constantly kind of on edge.
Kind of incentivize people not to become Orphicism? Because then if you believe in that, then you have to do things that are pretty much gods are arbitrary, because you can do things that can piss them off and you don't know about it.
Well,
that kind of
it's just how they explain the world, right?
Yeah.
Like, our lives are arbitrary, but we just you deal however you deal. You tell yourself what you need to say, right? Like, my parents tell themselves every time something bad happens, it happened for a reason. They don't know the reason. They will never know the reason.
It's
but they assume that there is a reason and someone is maneuvering their lives in a certain way. Or that adage that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Well, no, it doesn't. It cripples or it maims or it traumatizes you. But we tell ourselves that it makes us stronger because you have to go through it anyway. You might as well not let it break you, right? You live in the world, even now, where life is not clear cut. You don't know what to expect, and things could get fucked up at any time.
And this isn't just an Orphic thing. I think all of our philosophies, maybe the Epicureans, the least, but even they, are forced to observe religious practices. All of us make sacrifices every day. All of us give the chicken to Poseidon. So, like, this isn't an absurdity that is...
No,
like,
I don't think you could really opt out of the public religion in Greek life. I mean, you would be ostracized for, like, drawing the gods' wrath on your community. It's not just a personal religion. It's, I don't know, like being in the American South. Maybe you're really ostracized if you don't go to church.
Totally.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You're going to cause a problem for the rest of us if you don't. You don't have to believe it. You don't have to feel it in your heart, but you have to play along. This is the game. And so Orphism, I guess, plays into that same game. They're not asking anything too much above and beyond what you're already doing. They're just saying, hey, if you also come to this late night seminar, we'll talk about some stuff, and maybe you can skip the bad parts.
So now we're going to begin with Chris to give us a two-minute spiel argument of how we should live our life.
So I talked about it a little bit in my introduction about how the Stoics are sort of a natural offshoot or the natural ancestor to American culture today, and how we'd find a lot of what they have to say pretty natural. So I mean, the first one that Norman brought up, and I'm glad that he did in his introduction for Epicureanism, was that that humans now should live toward comfort and happiness. And I feel like there's an author, I can't think of her name now, and she was on the Colbert Report, I'll remember it soon. She's a cancer survivor, and she said that when she was diagnosed with cancer, everyone told her, think positively. If you think positively, you'll get through this. And she resented it. She resented having to think positively all the time because she didn't feel positive all the time. And her thing was, happiness should not be the thing we strive for. We shouldn't strive for happiness if it comes at the cost of our morality, our set of principles that we live by. So I think the Stoics would agree with me when I say that pleasure should not be our number one goal. Our number one goal should be to live virtuously. And if we live virtuously, we are emulating God, our creator, and we'll live a life of unity and harmony. And this is more important. I mean, if slavery made me happier because I didn't have to go out into the fields and cut down all my own hay and do all those things, I wouldn't be a better person because I had slaves. If I live virtuously, though, and unhappily, that is something that I can take with me and hold with me, and that will make me a better person. So I think the whole happiness argument should just be shot down immediately. I don't think any of us would agree that we should be happy before we should live morally. And I guess the second part is a little bit harder for people in the modern era. Okay, so it's hard for people to reconcile sort of their religious faith with how the Western society thinks about, like science and the observable world. So I think this is the hardest part about being a Stoic in the modern world. You have to be sort of trusting in the fact that there's some higher being who's trying to orchestrate everything so that things work out well for you. I think that would be troublesome, but I don't think it's that hard. I think there are a lot of mysteries in the world that are very good examples of how there must be something that is beyond our ken that can only be explained if we have some creator. I mean, the Stoics talk about how the pig is the perfect creature, and how the pig was made obviously for people to eat, and that is its purpose in life. And I can get behind that, but maybe that argument has holes in it. Like, so, I mean, a modern way of thinking about how the pig is the perfect thing for human beings and how there must have been a creator for the pig because bacon is so amazing would be that, like, I mean, you talk to astrophysicists today, 95% of the universe is dark matter. We can't see it. It's unobservable, and it's making our universe expand at an alarming rate when we should be having it contract. So, like, there are these unexplained phenomena that only make sense if there's something happening that we can't observe, can't see, but if there's some kind of, like, constructive force going on in the world. And it's obviously working to our benefit. We're around. We're a sentient species. We're the greatest species that's ever been created. And if it all happened just chaotically, as the Epicureans think, then, I mean, I don't know how we apply that to our lives. I don't know how chaos is supposed to help us live meaningful lives. And I think that's a cornerstone of what it means to be an Epicurean. I think the disbelief in God's having an active role in our lives is really not helpful for us living virtuous lives.
Okay. This is a clarification question because...
Sure.
Do the Stoics, do they care about virtues or happiness? Because at one point you said we should live in a virtuous life,
mm-hmm.
So that it will lead to all of us living in harmony and unity, and that would lead to happiness, which is the end goal. But at the same time, we shouldn't just achieve happiness. So is there like two kinds of happiness that we're talking about here, where one of them is real happiness and one of them is just luxurious material goods, that kind of happiness?
But,
what?
I mean, the Epicureans have a very specific type of happiness they're talking about. I mean, do you want to talk about that first, or no? The Stoics have a very set system of philosophy, a very set systematic philosophy. They've got it's basically the way that we conduct philosophy today. I'll just give you one bit here. The Stoics said that wisdom is scientific knowledge of the divine and the human, and that philosophy is the practice of expertise in utility. Virtue, singly, and at its highest, is utility, and virtues, at their most generic, are triple, the physical one, the ethical one, and the logical one. So these are, virtue for them comes in three forms, and this is how you live a full Stoic life, is by talking about the physics, that's the natural world, and this is about, like, what it means to, like, what things exist and what things are in our minds and how we live our lives, knowing those things. So that's a little more controversial and obscure, and I don't think it's natural to the Western world. But the next part, besides physics, is ethics and logic. For them, this is the very beginnings of how we think of logic today. So syllogisms and logical fallacies, these were all things that the Stoics came up with because they believed that you could reach truth by talking it out, which was great. They didn't think that everything was relative. They thought that there were objective truths and you could find them. So they inherited a lot of that from Plato, Socrates, Aristotle, those guys. And the ethics part is about basically living your life virtuously, which is something that was strange in Socrates' time. It was strange in the Hellenist time because the things that we think are necessarily virtuous aren't intuitive. One of them was something Socrates said, which is it's better to be harmed than to harm, which isn't something, I mean, people say might makes right all the time. So they weren't about intuitive things. They were about virtue, which was a little more finessed and a little more subtle. And I think it really appeals to, like, how we have to teach children morality today. It has to do with not being the aggressor, about accepting everyone. I think these are all, like, pretty pluralistic groups that come into the Hellenistic schools. So virtue is, like, the big thing that is propounded by the Stoics that no one else really talks about as much.
So one thing that still needs to be clarified, though, is like what is the specific relationship in Stoicism between virtue and happiness? Because in your pitch, you kind of just diametrically oppose them.
Well, I mean, I would say that virtue is the means by which you can reach the Greek word eudaimonia, which has to do with, I mean, it's translated as happiness, but a bunch of other things. But, like, this happiness has to do with, like, a serenity and a general feeling of goodwill and all those things. It's how you're not going to regret things at the very end. So, like, that kind of pure happiness, not, like, the short happiness that you get from, like, eating chocolate or, like, watching a movie. So, like, so the Stoics believe that happiness is, is an end, but it's not a means to get there. Like, if you live your life just trying to find everything that makes you happy all the time, you're going to run into a lot of problems. But if you live your life virtuously, which is doing the right thing, being courageous, telling the truth all the time, like, that will get you to happiness in the end, or a deep, profound happiness. Does that answer your question? Good.
So I have another question. So for the Stoics, like, if it is the case that happiness is the end goal, and that we should all act virtuously to achieve that end goal, and that is through that we all live in harmony and unity,
totally.
You know, everyone being virtuous.
Yes.
How is this going to reconcile with our real world right now, given that the idea that we're so individualistic that we can get to do whatever I want, of how the media portrays, and, you know,
you mean like how much like the Facebook syndrome, where like we're always trying to find our own identities and things, or
like
something?
Yeah, like we're all individual and that we can do whatever we want, you know, it is our, we want to create our own identity, and sometimes it comes to the point where people are selfish. And if that's the case, then how is that going to, because from my impression of Stoicism is that you need everyone's cooperation in order to have this harmony and unity, and so then you'll lead to happiness. But from the practical side of what's going on right now, it's that people are fairly individualistic.
Yeah, that's cool. I never thought about that before. It's like, okay, so that's sort of a pessimistic view. It sounds like what you're saying is that, like, you know, Stoicism is like a pretty like optimistic philosophy, and that most people don't like subscribe to that philosophy because they're all like evil people, like little evil people.
I'm not saying that they naturally are, but then so far it's what kind of
our society isn't compatible with it somehow.
Right.
I mean, that's a great point. I think.
Sorry, I don't have an answer to that
at
all.
I think in classical Greece, most people weren't compatible with it either. I think a lot of people were selfish and greedy in Athens. I mean, one of the great examples would be like Alcibiades, who's like Socrates' lover. But he's also known in Greek history for being like one of the greatest tramps ever. Like besides being Socrates' lover, he betrays the Greeks and Medizes, and supports like the Greeks' mortal enemy, the Medes, the
Persians.
And then like double crosses them. I mean, there were a lot of examples of bad people living in Athens too. It wasn't like Athens was any better a place. Not everyone needs to be a Stoic, but if you are a Stoic, you're not setting yourself up for like some kind of false ideal. Like, I mean, I don't want to pick on Orphism, but like you're not setting yourself up for disappointment if there isn't, an afterlife. You've lived your life well, so you don't need to worry about what happens next.
Right. Well, I mean, I feel like if there isn't an afterlife, you don't have time to be disappointed. So you might as well be hopeful.
I see how it's solved.
It's like your parents saying you're going to go to Disneyland and then you die before you get there. You didn't know the disappointment of not going to Disneyland.
But, like, so much of your life would be involved in planning for it. It would be such a waste to plan for Disneyland.
No, anticipation is sometimes the best part of life. Because reality can fall short.
But what if your whole life were planned based on this false belief? I feel like it'd be such a lie. You couldn't get much out of it.
Now, here's a very interesting point. This is actually what I was going to say here, is that one thing that I was missing. So I'm kind of betraying my own side for a minute here. I'm adopting the Stoic point. One thing that's very large in Stoics, at least, as Diogenes Laertius presents them, is this idea of the Stoic sage only acting on certain knowledge. Now, I think you make a very good and very Stoic point when you say that this life that's based on a lie isn't a proper one, because you are acting on something that isn't certain knowledge. But, and this is a little bit of an answer to your...
The cataleptic fantasia is what they call it.
And this is a little bit of an answer to your question here, which is how you live in a selfish world as a Stoic, which is that you act on certain knowledge. But I think what's required in order to live that kind of a life is to reject your original premise, which is that it's a reflection of our modern Western life. Because it seems to me that people are very much concerned with their first impressions, and that they don't act on certain knowledge, they act in the opposite way. So it seems to me that, you know, I disagree with your first point, but I think by jettisoning that one, you can actually possibly present an answer to the criticism, which is, you know, we actually aren't living Stoic lives in the modern age, but we should be, because we should be acting on certain knowledge.
Yeah, sure. It's great. Thanks.
Christian made a bit of an interesting point, and then sort of adopted the view of his own, on his own anyway. But he immediately kind of said that a life of pleasure is one we shouldn't even consider, and it leads you to this very selfish type of lifestyle in that. And in fact, it's very funny that this is in response to the first four points that Epicurus made, because in fact I can just turn to the fifth point that he told us and said that it is impossible to live pleasantly without living prudently, honorably, and justly, and impossible to live prudently, honorably, and justly without living pleasantly. And whoever lacks this cannot live pleasantly. So as far as Epicurus is concerned, these are one and the same thing, that a virtuous life is a life of pleasure. But of course, that goes the other way too, that the only way you can actually live a virtuous life is if you have a pleasurable life. And in fact, I think one thing that we can really look at here, if we want to be talking about, you know, a Western society and that, is to consider certain statistics about crime. You know, obviously, a certain amount of suffering or a certain amount of poverty tends to lead someone to doing certain behaviors that maybe they wouldn't have done in other circumstances. And it's because they need to meet certain needs. Now, that's not to say that there isn't responsibility for their actions. In fact, this is the great appeal of our philosophy here. Where Christian tells us that, you know, how can you live a life of chaos and you know, a virtue inside of chaos? Well, I actually look at it the other way around. It seems to me that if you've got a god coming in and intervening and sort of dictating the way that things should be, it seems to me that you're not as responsible as your action for your actions as you would be if there wasn't somebody intervening and sort of, you know, forcing you into an action here. I think Zeno probably puts it best, this would be one of the Stoics, when he talks about kind of being a dog tied to a, actually it may not have been Zeno, but one of the Stoics, who said that you've got a dog kind of tied to a cart. Now the dog can decide to go along with the cart, or the dog can decide not to, and one of these is going to end well for the dog. So it seems to me that, you know, if I've got a gun to my head and I do something unjust because somebody gave me the option of dying or performing that thing, I think a lot of us have quite a bit of sympathy for somebody in that situation, and we tend not to blame them for that. But in a world where, you know, I am actually responsible for my actions, where I don't have something pushing me and making me do certain things, I think I am very much responsible for my actions. And it seems to me the kind of life that Epicurus is advocating is the sort of one that's in line with the virtue that the Stoics are talking about. And of course, this is the last and most important point here, is that we had to force it out of the Stoics, but eventually we did tell them. It's like, okay, well, if the goal is virtue, what is that goal really serving? It's like, well, it's this life of peace and tranquility and happiness, and this is exactly what we're talking about. The only thing that we're saying here is maybe we don't need all of these intermediaries. Maybe we don't need some guy who said that, well, I went to school for 4 years, and so I'm going to tell you the best way to, you know, to do this, or you have to meet these certain rites to live the right kind of life. We basically just come down to the point, we say, why do people have pain? Why do people have misery? Well, they're afraid what's going to happen to them when they die. And they actually just kind of have a fear in general in terms of why the world is behaving that it was. Again, if I quote Epicurus, if our suspicions about heavenly phenomena and about death did not trouble us at all, and there was never, and they were never anything to us, and moreover, if not knowing the limits of pains and desires did not trouble us, then we would have no need for natural science. We kind of recognize the fact that this fear of the unknown is a cause of great unhappiness in our lives. And in fact, this kind of gets to the point of the woman who had cancer. We're not saying to have a false idea of happiness. I mean, we're just kind of looking for this life where we say, we don't necessarily know what's going to come. We should know things as best as we can so that we can remove these fears of the unknown. And then the next step is to live this tranquil life amongst friends. We can withdraw from our communities because in the end, these are people who will look out for us, people who will take care of us. And in this life, we kind of live one of moderation. We take only what we need, and we do have certain pleasures every now and again. But the important thing here is to live this kind of life that people keep accusing us of this, you know, unbridled consumption or something like that. It seems to me that we become reliant on those items. And in the end, once we become reliant on them, a random world could take them away from us, and all of a sudden we're unhappy again. So maybe to get back to the woman with cancer in my closing point, I'm not going to tell her that she should be happy for the sake of being happy, but I think she has some memories from before that can provide her happiness and comfort in her suffering. And more importantly, I would certainly hope, and it certainly seems to be this is what happened to her, that she has the hope for a recovery in the future. And I think that both of these things can provide her happiness. And all of a sudden, we're not trying to defer any kind of happiness for some service to the gods or for some ideal of virtue or that. We are living virtuous lives because those are the ones that give us happiness.
Okay, so in the same way that I rebutted Chris on the practical side of your argument, I also want to talk about the practical side here. So to give you an example, my aunt recently went to Tibet for just for vacation. She wanted to see what it's like with people living there. And she found out that people were living quite Epicurean in the sense that they're fairly impoverished relative to Canada, to America, to first world countries. However, they are very happy. They have their basic needs. They have food, water, shelter, etc. They don't desire for all these goods, these material goods that we currently now have. So we can say because they haven't been exposed, we can probably say that, yeah, because they haven't been exposed to modernity, to technology, and so they don't have these ideas of desires. And so they are able to achieve this Epicurean happiness. However, if we come back to people who are living in first world countries like here in Canada, how are we going to persuade them that, you know, those people that are living, those people, these Tibetans, are actually happier than you are, and actually we should give up all these luxurious goods, these material goods, and live like them?
Well, I suppose there's a slight disagreement I have with your question, which is that I don't believe that the Epicurean life is one of poverty. I believe it's possible to be in a very affluent society and still live a life of moderation. I think the important thing about North America is that we certainly have a great endowment of technology,
and that these devices have actually freed up quite a bit of our time. So when we have manufacturing, that's just more time for us to pursue certain pleasures. But I think your point about Tibet also kind of shows that this is a philosophy that really the whole world can adopt, that it's not, you know, happiness is not a function of wealth. Happiness is a function about how you tend to use it. And so I agree with you that there's a bit of a problem in when you compare somebody to Tibet and somebody in North America, but I'm not entirely sure that that really wouldn't be putting the best argument in the Epicurean's mouth. I think what the Epicurean needs to argue to our modern society is to say that if you spread your consumption over a certain period of time, if you moderate it, then you're going to live a happier life. I will agree with you that I think the best version of this argument is found when somebody is miserable after a hangover, or if, you know, somebody's in a particular fear of death or that. And I'll also say that does have some historical precedence, which is usually you will tend to find Stoics becoming Epicureanism once they get an eye infection, because people actually find out that all of a sudden pleasure isn't an immaterial thing. But to answer your question directly, I think the best case that's made for Epicureanism to the modern day is to say that we do have some concerns about sustainability. And I think there is a certain kind of consensus that the consumerism isn't really the last word. I think that's become kind of mainstream enough that people tend to dislike this idea of possessions being the last word of your existence. And I think Epicureanism is a way that we don't have to fall to abject poverty, but we can kind of moderate that and say, you know what, it's okay to have things. And you know what, Epicureans are totally fine with having a party every once and again. But there's a difference between relying on these possessions, which we may be falling victim of in North America, and then there's just this idea of, you know, these are nice things to have, and we've got them, so why don't we use them? Does that kind of answer your question?
Because from my impression of it's just that Epicureans, they advocate needs only, and that wants are a little bit luxurious, and you shouldn't have them. You should only keep with the needs, which is the fundamentals of food, water, and shelter. And the reason that I compare it to Tibet is that though they are impoverished, they do have those needs fulfilled.
Mm-hmm.
So, but then again, like, to tell people in the first world countries, to tell them, hey, maybe you should live moderately, you know, and strip away your luxurious life,
mm-hmm.
strip away capitalism, right? And
yeah.
just live moderately. How are you going to persuade these people and say, you know, don't buy your Gucci and Chanel's, you know, like they're not going to bring you happiness at all. You should look up to these people here who only have their needs and they can live happily.
Right. And again, this is a slight difference in terms of the question, which is to say that certainly an Epicurean would believe that you can't have a happy life if you don't have your needs taken care of. But certainly feasting is part of Epicureanism. If you have a feast every once in a while, that's an even better life than having a subsistence existence. And so as far as I'm concerned, as an Epicurean, I would never tell somebody that a Gucci bag doesn't bring them happiness. I could go to any one of my friends and they will tell them that it makes them very happy. But I think that you would also agree with me that buying a Gucci bag every single day suddenly gives you a reliance on those kinds of possessions, and you're really not going to be any happier for it. The highest pleasures of Epicureanism are indeed the ones that come from a freedom of disturbance, but if you happen to have that extra endowment that allows you to get some extra pleasures, so much the better. But the most important thing is to enjoy them in moderation. And again, to your point of North America, I think that's the part where we're missing out. And I happen to think that when you talk to somebody who's unhappy, it's not the easiest case to make. But I do think somebody who is at a point of unhappiness is a little bit more ready to hear that message than somebody who's just kind of in the throes of excess. So, and of course, I mean, obviously whether or not people buy it doesn't mean that it's right or wrong. But my persuasion would usually rely on somebody who is, you know, I guess the best example, the song Richard Corey, right? It would be wonderful if one of us could get to Richard Corey before he killed himself and said, listen, this is where it went wrong, and here's the way that you can fix this.
They say that Richard Corey owns half of this old town. With political connections, he spread his wealth around. He was born into society. A
And that's our show for today. I hope you liked it. If you did, or if you didn't, let us know at the In the Agora site. That's socrates.arts.ubc.ca/agora, A-G-O-R-A. Special thanks to Grace Kung for moderating our discussion. At the end of the day, we hoped we could persuade her to adopt one of the lifestyles we were promoting, and you can see her decision at the website. Jason Newton put us in touch with her and her Ethics Bowl team at UBC. Norman Chalk and Lisa Tweeten discussed the Epicureans and Orphic religion and their regular contributors to the In the Agora site. And the legendary Andre Myaluk sat in on the discussion and put together the music for a couple of the little interludes throughout the show. He and Lisa are working with a group of students at UBC to catalog the hundreds of squeezes of inscriptions collected over the years in the Sinners Department. Check out the good work they're doing at fromstonetoscreen.wordpress.com. This is more than just a great project site, it's an all-around great hub of resources for classicists and archaeologists in general. The music for our credits was performed by musician Chris Metz. You can hear more of his work on SoundCloud. Search Butch Tuffington. Lastly, thanks to our boss, Professor Michael Griffin, for getting the In the Agora site up and bringing all of us together. It's been a great summer. Thanks to all of you for listening. Bye. I wish that I could be, Lord, I wish that I could be, you know, I wish that I could be Richard Corey.
God damn it! No, TA off of me.